history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that need to be told, and we're always better off for hearing them. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in a place I've never been before, Mankato, Minnesota, with 94-year-old Lee Nordgren, who grew up here and is still living here, father of five, grandfather to seven, and recipient of the Navy Cross, which is pretty unique in itself. But I want to go way back before that, Lee, who just celebrated his 94th birthday here in Mankato, by the way. Growing up here in Mankato, Minnesota, during the Great Depression and those years prior to World War II, what was that childhood like around here?
Well, I was quite fortunate in that my mother and father did have a better income than most of the people in our neighborhood. So I was spoiled that way. The interesting thing was that as I grew up, we moved into that home on North 5th Street when I was 2 years old. And until I was 10, the Catholic neighborhood kept saying every day, "Lee, you're not going to heaven because you're not Catholic." So I became interested in religion and had been brought up as a Lutheran, but it has expanded since then. I'm not a religious person. I am an honest person. I was in business for 49 years, and I can truly say I never once intentionally cheated a customer.
And that business was photography, which is something your father had experience with in World War I. And is it true that seeing a picture of him with flight goggles is what got you interested in aviation?
I think so. My dad had shown an interest in there. And then when I was probably around 10 or 12, I took a ride in a Ford trimotor with my grandfather on my mother's side, which fascinated me. And I thought, well, I want to learn how to do this. And so as I got older, got to be 16, I saved up money to fly when I could and reached the point of soloing before I was driving a car.
What was that first solo flight in? What kind of plane?
Well, that was a Cub. Yeah, it's a small airplane that actually has room for two. It has a stick in the front for each of the people who are there. And then you have your feet on rudders. You learn to coordinate. And it was such an early start for me that I was way ahead when I eventually went down to Mason City, Iowa to start my Navy career.
And there's something that happened before that I like to ask everybody about, because it seems like you all have a memory of December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were or how you found out what had happened out at Pearl Harbor?
Well, I was a senior in high school then. I think I was at the YMCA down on 2nd Street, which doesn't exist anymore. Yeah, that made a big adjustment. And I was fascinated by naval aviation. But at that time, you had to be a college graduate before you could fly for the Navy. And they changed that program over to call it the V5. And you had to be then simply 18 years of age, have good high school grades, and a very healthy body.
And so really not too long after Pearl Harbor, less than a year, you joined the Navy. How did your parents feel about that?
My parents they're both deceased now, obviously. They're patriots, and they believe that we should all help our country. That's a big plus. So when I said that I was going to join, at the same time, they were so good to me that I have a feeling they anticipated that I may not come home. For example, when I got my wings down in Pensacola in April of 44, I became an ensign. I was just 19 years old. But they drove down to Florida with Dr. and Mrs. Wentworth, looked around a little bit, and then left the car for me to use until I went to combat.
That says a lot right there. And I understand you learned something about your father's time in World War I that you'd never heard before. You'd grown up seeing this picture of him with a leather helmet and flight goggles, but you misinterpreted it?
Yeah, that was interesting. I always thought he had been a naval aviator then, and it turns out he was an aerial photographer. And when he came home from the Navy, career, he became a photo finisher and produced prints and film for drugstore dealers, 100 of them in southern Minnesota here, with a big operation.
Well, I can imagine that all of the people listening right now who, like you, are aviation fanatics, they probably want to know, well, if his dad was flying in World War I, what kind of aircraft was he flying in the teens, you know, before 1920?
Well, the planes that they flew were multi-engine, and the pilots sat way back from where the aerial photographer was. He was right up in front, so things didn't get in the way. They had to sensitize the film some way and then take the picture, bring it back down, and finish up the processing. Pretty primitive.
Very primitive, and flying was really not that safe in those days. And it still wasn't that safe when you started flying for the Navy. I bet there were some things in training that underscored that reality.
Well, over the time that I trained, there were a number of people who died in the training program. In fact, I think we lost more in training than we did in combat. This is as a carrier-based fighter pilot.
And when you say that, you lost more in training than in combat, I imagine if you're losing guys, at some point, they're people that you actually know, guys that you've actually trained with or gotten to know.
Yeah, that's true. There were several of them. Pilots in my class of 42 at Mankato High. One Smith disappeared from his carrier and was never seen again. They have no idea what happened to him.
So when things like that happen, do they make you wonder what's going to happen to you? What your ultimate fate in these high-powered machines up there in the sky going so fast is going to be?
Well, you have to use common sense and care. For example, when my brother died in 1955, the young man that brought him home, brought his body home for the funeral, was later killed in another accident, hitting the side of a hill or something. You just don't know what to expect, but you should be more careful than sometimes we are.
Yeah, and you allude to your brother, and this is a decade after World War II, but he had gotten into aviation following your example, and he died in a jet crash?
Yeah, in fact, they were doing a tail chase over one of the fields there in the San Diego area. And how it all came about is still a little fuzzy for me. So I can't really describe how it all came about, which is unfortunate because I'm sure John would like to have me know.
I wonder if there are any records we could find on that might shed a little light. And I imagine in some ways what you dealt with in World War II, if anything, can prepare you for dealing with that kind of loss. Maybe it's some of what you endured during the war. But let's go back to those training days. So you have this dream of flying. You're in the Navy now. You're in the program to become a fighter pilot. Was there a particular plane that you had your heart set on that you were hoping they'd let you get in the cockpit of?
Well, I never really knew that much about which aircraft was a top performer. When I went into the Navy, the F-4F Wildcat was the primary aircraft, and it was a dog. It was a terrible airplane. The Japanese were shooting them down left and right, which is one of the reasons they changed the regulations on getting more pilots. But then came along the F-6F Hellcat and the Corsair, and they both had a 2,000 horsepower engine. I flew the Hellcat during the war. It was a wonderful airplane. I flew the Corsair in reserve after the war, and it had a lot of flaws in there, and it really wasn't a good aircraft to be landing and taking off from a carrier.
How'd you feel about this idea of taking off and landing on a carrier? A little different than landing on those runways where you learned to fly here in Minnesota.
Well, first off, the Hellcat was such a wonderful airplane to fly. It was almost a treat every time I got in it. It was like having candy available all the time. In fact, after the war, my wife said, when I was in the reserve, she said, "Do they know they wouldn't have to pay you?"
Don't tell them.
Oh, it was a very stable airplane. And a lot of planes have characteristics that can get you into trouble without your being aware of you're getting into trouble. But the Hellcat was such a kind airplane, it would kind of remind you by its movements that you should get the nose down or add power before you get into trouble. That wasn't true with the Corsair. There'd be a lot of people alive today that are dead having flown the Corsair.
Well, and you made that comment before that you think there were more killed in training than in combat. So that makes me wonder about your experience in training. I'm sure you flew a lot of different planes as you progressed, the SNJ, the old Volte Vibrator, and all of those. Did you have some close calls? Were there some training flights that made you a little anxious or made you wonder?
Well, at Barron Field, that was the last field that we were at before we got our wings. The French sent a whole bunch of cadets over, and they totally ignored all the rules. So you had a quadrant that you had to be in. They ignored the rules about which quadrant you had to be in, and they just flying all over and running into each other. In fact, that's how we got the name Bloody Baron instead of just Baron. So we got a little hairy towards the end.
That doesn't sound that encouraging.
No, it wasn't encouraging. The SNJ, by the way, you had mentioned, very stable airplane and a good trainer. The Navy was very good about that. That was also called the AT-6, the Texan, I think. We're going back a long ways now, you know.
Many years, but I'm sure some of our listeners have either seen or been in those. They have some AT-6s going around that they give people rides in, and I think I've even put the landing gear down in one of those. So as you're going through all this time in training, you'd gone in 42, and time's going by, the war's changing. I'm sure you're hearing news come back, and maybe guys you knew were already over there. Were you a little antsy to get overseas?
Well, I felt that I had a moral obligation to participate after spending as much of their money training me and knowing that this Culpens that I flew off of was not a cheap operation. So I felt we ought to be doing something effective with it, which we ultimately did. Not for too long, though, because the war ended 3 months after I got into combat.
But in that very short time in combat, you actually came home with something that most Navy pilots never did, a Navy Cross. And I know that wasn't your goal. That's not what you were aiming for. But we've got to hear that story. Tell me about that carrier, though, the Culpens. Give people today maybe some perspective on the uniqueness of the situation back then as far as carriers go and what it was like for you to get aboard that floating city.
Well, the Culpens was actually made on a cruiser hull, and cruisers were designed a lot like destroyers. And if you've ever watched a destroyer go through the water, it was pitching and rolling all the time. They are not what you'd call a real stable ship. So here we have a dozen cruiser hulls that they've now converted to carriers. So each landing and takeoff that you experience is a new experience. It's either rolling, pitching, going up and down. Or it was challenging. But I loved the Hellcat so much that it wasn't that dangerous for me to do. I just felt very comfortable with the aircraft.
And how many guys, how many other pilots were in your squadron? VF-50, was it?
VF-50, we had about 50 fighter pilots. And then we had some black shoes, that is, people who were helping us with the other duties than flying.
And what kind of connection or relationship or camaraderie did you have with those other flyers?
The people on the big carriers kind of poo-pooed us. They thought that the Culpens and the Independence, which was the other carrier that was in the task force of five, there were three big carriers, and those guys said, I'd rather land in the damn ocean than on your Culpens. So yeah, it was interesting.
And I know a lot of people have heard about, you know, the Mighty Mo, because they've been on the battleship Missouri, and they know that that's the ship where the surrender was signed in September of 45. But maybe they haven't heard the nickname of your carrier, the Culpens.
The Culpens was actually named after a Revolutionary War experience. It was Mary's Culpen that was actually fought over and won by the revolutionaries, that is the people on George Washington's side. It was a battle of about 30 people, so it wasn't a big thing, but it was one of the rare ones that they won.
So the name, the USS Culpens, came from that Revolutionary War battle, but then they had a nickname for your ship, too. It wasn't the Mighty Mo.
Yeah, it was the Mighty Moo.
The Mighty Moo, yeah. For Culpens, yeah. Did you guys get some chuckles out of that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it was a good era carrier, though.
And we'll hear more about the USS Culpens and specifically a mission that Lee Nordgren flew off of that carrier on July 25th, 1945. What he did to be awarded the Navy Cross. You can check out photos and video of Lee online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.